and welcome to this Herbert Smith Freehills podcast. I'm Maura McIntosh, and I'm a professional support consultant in the disputes team in London and one of the general editors of our textbook Class Actions in England and Wales, published by Sweet and Maxwell. I have with me Julian Copeman, who's a London disputes partner and one of the authors of the textbook. This is the fourth in our series of podcasts to mark the launch of our second edition, and in this episode we'll focus on data class actions. Now, data is an obvious area for potential class actions, given the exponential growth in the volumes of personal data collected and shared by businesses in recent years, the development of legal rights in relation to data and increased public awareness of those rights, and the fact that the loss or misuse of data can affect very large numbers of individuals. As many listeners will be aware, this is an area that generated quite a lot of excitement, particularly because the Court of Appeals decision in the Lloyd and Google case a couple of years ago suggested that it might be possible to pursue data class actions in the English courts on an opt-out basis, using the hitherto rarely used CPR 19 representative action procedure. Now, the Supreme Court's decision in that case in late 2021 took some of the wind out of those sails, but a very recent High Court decision may breathe new life back into the debate. So we'll come back to talk about all that, as it's really very significant for the future of data class actions and class actions generally. But before we do that, Julian, can you give listeners some context by explaining what sorts of claims we're talking about when we refer to data class actions?
Thanks, Maura. Yes, and hello, everyone. So data class actions can be brought relying on a various causes of action. Typically, those will include breaches of data protection legislation. So historically, that would be the Data Protection Act 1998, and now would be under the GDPR or UK GDPR and Data Protection Act 2018. But you'll also have claims in misuse of private information, breach of confidence, and there may also be claims for breach of contract or consumer legislation or negligence. And increasingly, as we may come on to later, breaches of competition law. Perhaps a simpler way of looking at these actions is to see them as falling into two broad categories, first being data security breaches and second being sort of challenges to business use of data. So that first type, these are claims relating to data security breaches where there's been, for example, a cyber attack or perhaps some technical fault which has caused data to be lost, destroyed or altered. And the second broad type is where the claim is being used really to challenge the business use of data. So claims arising from alleged unlawful use or misuse of personal data of a business's customers or other individuals. A high profile example of the first sort of claim relating to data security breaches is the Morrisons case, which related to a disgruntled employee of the Morrisons supermarket chain who published the payroll data of about 100,000 Morrisons employees on the internet. The employee was identified and successfully prosecuted, but the incident led to a group claim against Morrisons by about 10,000, so about 10% of the affected employees, alleging not only direct liability under relevant data protection legislation, but also that Morrisons was vicariously liable for the employee's action, even though he'd been acting maliciously. Now, those claims ultimately failed, although the vicarious liability claim had to go all the way to the Supreme Court before it was held to be unsustainable. An example of the second category is the Lloyd and Google case you mentioned, Maura, which relates to the alleged misuse of customers' data. In that case, Richard Lloyd, a former executive director of the UK Consumers Association, sought to bring a claim against Google on behalf of more than 4 million UK resident iPhone users, alleging that some of their internet activity had been secretly tracked by the defendant for commercial purposes in 2011 and 2012 in breach of the Data Protection Act 1998. And that claim, as you mentioned, was also ultimately failed at the Supreme Court level.
Thanks for that. Yeah, as I said earlier, the Lloyd and Google claim is very significant, particularly because it was an attempt to bring a data class action on an opt-out basis. But before we say anything more about the case specifically, can you just briefly explain the opt-in, opt-out distinction and why it's so important?
Yes. So an opt-out action is the sort of class action claim that most people think of when they hear the phrase class action. And it's the model you see in the US, where a claim can be brought on behalf of the entire class of those alleged to have suffered from particular conduct, which could be taking medication which turned out to have damaging side effects or buying a product at an inflated price due to a cartel, or in the present context, having their personal data made public in some way as a result of a data breach. By contrast, an opt-in class action is one where the claimants have to take a positive step to join a class, join a group, in order to benefit from it. Now, for obvious reasons, opt-out actions are much more attractive to claimants, and in particular to funders of claims, because you don't need to go out and advertise and persuade individual claimants to come forward and join your claim, which, you know, can be time-consuming and costly. As I mentioned earlier, you only might only get quite a small group. So 10% of those affected in the Morrison's claim joined that group. Now, that could be quite challenging where the individual claims themselves are quite a low value, even though the total loss is quite large, because there's not a lot of incentive really for the individual claimants to sign up. Most class actions in English courts do have to be brought on an individual basis or managed together in some way, such as a group litigation order or other bespoke case management regime. But the fundamental point is that you've got to get individual claimants to sign up and be named, to opt in to that claim. There is an exception for competition claims, which is the Competition Appeal Tribunal, for which there's a specific regime that allows claims to be brought as either opt in or opt out, depending on what the tribunal considers most suitable in the particular case.
Yes, the competition regime that you mentioned was considered in the second podcast in this series back in January. So I'd encourage listeners to go back and play that episode if they want more detail on that regime. And as flagged earlier, of course, there's one other exception to the opt-in model in the English courts, which is the representative action procedure. Now, that's of very long standing, but it's currently embodied in CPR 19.6, I should say soon to be CPR 19.8 under some rule changes that are going to come in from the 6th of April, which don't actually make substantive changes, but they've reorganised and rationalised the relevant rules to some extent. So whatever it's called, can you tell us about that procedure?
Yes, the representative action allows a claim to be brought on behalf of all those who've got the same interest in it. So there's no need for the representative parties to come forward or be named, as I was just talking about, for an opt-in claim. The representative parties are bound by any judgment or order in the case, although such a judgment or order can only be enforced by or against the representative parties with the court's permission. Essentially, though, the representative action procedure has not been widely used over the years because the court has always had a strict interpretation of this same interest requirement. It's always been generally considered that it couldn't be used to bring a damages claim, since in general terms, even where the claimants have suffered as a result of the same wrongdoing, the loss and damage will usually vary between them depending on the claimant's individual circumstances.
Yes, so if it was thought that the representative action couldn't be used to claim damages, maybe you could just explain how the claimant in the Lloyd and Gould case hoped to be able to recover on behalf of the representative class using that regime.
Yes, I mean, this seemed to be, for a while, a way to really open up opt-out claims in the data class action sphere. And it was because the claimant in Lloyd and Google had seemingly found a way around the problem caused by the same interest requirement. In particular, because they were disavowing any reliance on the individual circumstances of class members when they brought forward the claim. So the case was that damages could be awarded under the Data Protection Act 1998 on the basis of an equal standard tariff award for each class member to reflect the infringement of their rights and their loss of control of their personal data. It was, in a sense, a lowest common denominator claim for everybody within that class, not taking into account any other particular issues facing individual members of the class. Initially, the High Court refused to allow the action to proceed as a representative action, saying that the compensation could not be awarded under the Act merely for the fact of the infringement and associated loss of control over personal data. But then the Court of Appeal disagreed and allowed the claim to proceed on the basis that damages were in principle capable of being awarded for loss of control of data, and the Court of Appeal's view that the judge had applied too stringent a test of the same interest. So at that point, it appeared that the court would be allowed to go forward. The Court of Appeal had allowed it to go forward as a representative action. And as you say, that generated a lot of excitement because it appeared to mean that data class actions could potentially be brought on behalf of very large numbers of individuals on this representative action basis. And even if the damages that could be awarded on to any individual, you know, in the data action were small, and that was likely to be the case because you're talking about a loss of control of personal data while stripping out particular personal circumstances, and we're talking about this lowest common denominator I mentioned, the aggregate award could be very large because of the numbers of people involved in any particular class and the opt-out nature of that class, which was making claims like that extremely attractive to litigation funders, who obviously would take a cut from those damages, and extremely high risk for businesses. But by way of an example from the Lloyd and Google case itself, the claimants were suggesting a putative tariff of £750 per head for the individual class members. Now, putting aside whether that was realistic or too high, or using that number, when you've got a proposed class of some 4 million people, that was leading to a claim of about £3 billion. And so you can understand that while the post the Court of Appeal judgment and pending the Supreme Court judgment, a number of claims were either being brought, you know, brought forward, stayed pending the Supreme Court judgment, or generally being prepared. So there was a lot of interest, and potentially would have been a lot of claims coming forward if the Supreme Court had upheld the Court of Appeal. However, as you mentioned, in November 2021, the Supreme Court allowed Google's appeal against the early judgment of the Court of Appeal, and found that the relevant provisions of the 1998 Act could not be interpreted as giving right to a compensation wherever a non-trivial data breach was committed. In other words, you had to have some actual damage suffered as a consequence of any breach, which has to be separate from the breach itself. And so the claimants couldn't recover without proof of either material damage, such as financial loss, or mental distress. And because the claimants had declined to plead causation of damage on an individual basis, given that they disavowed that and were trying to go for this uniform tariff, the claim was essentially bound to fail.
Thanks. So does the Lloyd and Google decision ultimately mean the door is closed to data class actions being brought on an opt-out basis using that procedure?
Well, not necessarily. There are a few potential avenues that have been left open to pursue or potentially pursue that arise from the Lloyd and Google decision. And actually, as you mentioned earlier, there's been a very recent High Court decision in a case called Commission Recovery and Marks and Clark that might actually liberalise the position even further, although that wasn't a data class action, and it's not clear yet how that decision might translate across into data claims.
Thanks. That's interesting. Let's come back to the Marks and Clark decision. But first, maybe if you could explain what avenues Lloyd and Google itself leaves open for claimants who want to bring opt-out data actions using this representative action procedure.
Sure. The first point to note is that Lord Leggett, giving the judgment of the Supreme Court, expressly stated that the need for individual assessment of damages for a representative action doesn't necessarily preclude using it to resolve some elements of a claim. He suggested, in fact, that there could be what he called a bifurcated process in which common issues are decided through a representative claim, leaving any issues which require individual determination to be dealt with later through separate claims. In fact, Lord Leggett went as far as to comment that if Mr. Lloyd had proposed a bifurcated process of that sort, he couldn't see any objection to there having been a representative claim to establish liability, to establish whether Google was in breach of the relevant legislation. And then that the any ensuing actual damages claims, if they'd succeeded, could have been brought subsequently on an individual basis. Now, the obvious difficulty in trying to bring those sorts of bifurcated claims is how you would fund that. As I mentioned earlier, these class actions generally have funders behind them. But if you're only going to fund the initial liability stage, how do you get funded? Because at that stage, there's not going to be a pot of damages from which the law firm and the funder can get paid, because you're only dealing with liability. And there might well be, depending on whether the initial stage had succeeded, damages at a later stage. But of course, the litigation funder, the original claimant law firm, has no control over that later stage. So there'd be no guarantee that they would benefit from subsequent success in damages claims. Other funders could come in at that point, potentially offer cheaper deals, and for the damages stage. And so the original funder might not recoup their stage one costs at all. So it's essentially a free rider problem. Now, when this all first came out, there'd been sufficient interest in the possibility of opt-out representative action claims in this area that a lot of thought went into whether there were creative solutions around that, such that these kind of claims could be brought on a bifurcated basis. But here we are sort of 18 months later, and I'm not aware of any funders who've come back and tried to bring one of these claims on a bifurcated approach. So it looks like that funding barrier is turning out to be a substantial one.
Thanks. Yeah, I can see that funding the representative stage of that process might not be an attractive prospect. So it's hard to see how those claims could get off the ground in practice. You said there are a few potential avenues left over for claims by Lewd and Google before getting into the complication of the Marks and Clark case. So do you want to comment on the others?
Yes, thanks. I mean, the others are to do with the particular cause of action that was pursued in Lloyd and Google. As I mentioned, that was a claim under the old 1998 Data Protection Act, rather than the current legislation, which is essentially the UK GDPR, which superseded it. And Lord Leggett said expressly that he was not considering the position under the GDPR. So that does leave the door potentially open for future loss of control claims under the current legislation, particularly because the compensation regime under the GDPR expressly refers to compensation being available for not only material damages, but also non-material damages. And the recitals to the GDPR specifically reference loss of control over personal data as an example of possible damage resulting from a personal data breach. Now, it did appear that this issue might be tested quite soon in a claim that was being a class action being brought against TikTok, which had been stayed pending the Supreme Court's judgment in Lloyd and Google. And following that judgment, the defendants invited the claimant to discontinue the claim on the basis of the findings of the Supreme Court in Lloyd and Google. But instead, the claimant applied for permission to serve the claim out of the jurisdiction, arguing that the Supreme Court judgment was irrelevant because this claim, this TikTok claim, was brought under the GDPR and also misuse of private information, which we'll come back to in a moment. And the court accepted that there was a serious issue to be tried as to the proper interpretation of the GDPR and whether the Supreme Court's conclusion in Lloyd and Google could properly be distinguished. And so on that basis, they gave permission to serve the claim out of the jurisdiction. As it turned out, the claim was discontinued a few months later. So it does remain to be seen whether going forward, claimants will try to and be able to pursue representative claims in a similar sort of way as the claim that was attempted in Lloyd and Google, but under the GDPR, seeking damages on a uniform tariff basis in the particular circumstance of the GDPR, and whether that would make a difference. The other possibility, as I've just alluded to, is a claim for tort of misuse of private information rather than under data protection legislation. That's a tort of strict liability. So you don't need to show that the misuse caused any material damage or distress. And it was actually recognised in Lloyd and Google that it would have been open to Mr. Lloyd to claim damages for misuse of private information, at least in his own right, without the need to show damages in that sense. So there is a question as to whether representative action could be brought relying on misuse of private information without the need to plead individual circumstances. And again, we may see this play out because there is a claim on foot where the claim is trying to do just that, which is a claim against Google and DeepMind Technologies on behalf of some 1.6 million individuals alleging unlawful use of their confidential medical records. The obvious challenge for such claims is that even if damages can be awarded without proof of material damage or distress on this kind of lowest common denominator type basis, The court may still need to look at factors such as the extent of the misuse of individuals' private information to assess damages. And in other words, there may not be a neat tariff that could be awarded in a representative action without the need to consider individual circumstances. Anyway, I understand that there is an application to strike out the DeepMind Technologies claim at some point this quarter, so we may not have to wait too long to find the answer to that question.
Thanks, that's interesting. Lots to look out for there. So coming back to the Marks and Clark case then, can you tell us a bit about that case and how it might affect the landscape for claimants who want to bring representative actions on an opt-out basis?
Yeah, so this is very recent, as I said, late February, a decision by Mr. Justice Knowles in which he allowed claims for secret commissions to proceed as a representative action on behalf of all those clients for whom the relevant commissions were paid. So it's not a data class action, but in the context of everything we've been talking about, not in Google, it's it looks like it could be pretty important. The context of that case, of the Marks and Clark case, is that they were all clients of a firm of patent attorneys, and the secret commissions were paid allegedly in respect of client referrals to an IP renewal services provider. But the background doesn't really matter. The important point is that the decision, Mr. Justice Knowles' decision, appears to go much further than the Supreme Court's decision in Lloyd and Google. As I said a bit earlier, Lord Leggett in Lloyd and Google recognised that you might have a bifurcated procedure where you bring a representative action for instance, liability, but then where individual circumstances and clients differ, you would have individual claims. So essentially, you're bifurcating the genuinely same interest elements as a representative action, and then having a different individual actions or smaller group actions for issues which do not fall within the standard view of what the same interest is. In this more recent case, Mr. Justice Knowles seemed to accept that actually a representative action was appropriate simply because there was no actual conflict of interest between the claimants, even though there were obvious differences between their claims in terms of things like quantum, limitation and knowledge, which would normally, on some traditional view, not count as having the same interest. So I'll have to see where that goes. I understand that Mr. Justice Knowles is due to hear an application for permission to appeal. If he refuses permission, no doubt the defendants will seek permission from the Court of Appeal. So subject to how all that progresses, the decision could lead to a more liberal approach to the use of the representative action procedure. Given the kind of clear finding in Lloyd and Google about bifurcated actions and so on, it may not be easy to apply that kind of liberal approach to claims, at least under the Data Protection Act 1998, because the Supreme Court there was quite clear about the need to prove damage on an individual basis. So we'll have to see, but as far as representative actions in relation to data breaches are concerned, we might still be left with that bifurcated approach, subject to the points I was making about GDPR and misuse of private information, but it may have a much, much more broad impact more widely.
Interesting. Thank you. So moving away from representative actions then, are there any other routes that claimants can take to pursue data claims, on a class or collective basis?
Yes. Yeah, so, of course, the traditional opt-in approaches are available and are used. You can still club together to bring a group action or a GLO. One example, and there are a number over the last few years, but one example is the British Airways data event litigation, which relates back to a cyber attack in 2018. And that was a case where a group litigation order was made, and the case has in fact since settled. But it illustrates, I think, the challenge of bringing data claims on an opt-in basis. I understand that about 23,000 claimants out of 500,000 or so individuals had received notification from BA about the breach and therefore were in principle eligible to bring the claim, actually signed up, and that's about 5%, so even lower than the 10% I mentioned in relation to Morrison's. It's not a massive take-up rate, and you can see that, on an individual basis, actually opting in where the likely damages per head aren't going to be very high is a bit of a challenge to gather people up and get them to join the group. Interestingly, another route we're seeing at the moment, it seems to be to try to reformulate what is essentially a data class action as a competition claim, typically by alleging abuse of dominant position. And of course, the purpose of that is that you may be able to bring that as an opt-out claim in the Competition Appeal Tribunal. And one example of what's been happening on that recently is the claim that was brought against Meta or Facebook in 2022. Now, that phenomenon isn't limited to data claims. Other claims have been brought under the aegis of the competition regime, which you wouldn't obviously class as competition claims, to try to get that opt-out procedure. And so other examples will be recently publicised claims against water and sewage companies relating to water quality. But it's definitely noticeable that's happening in the data claims sphere. In fact, the claim against Meta has received a significant setback recently. The Competition Appeal Tribunal sent the claims back to think again about their proposed methodology for assessing damages, saying that there would need to be a root and branch evaluation before a collective proceedings order could be made in that case. The tribunal granted a six-month stay of the application for that purpose, so we'll have to wait and see whether the claimants can satisfy the tribunal on a second attempt so that the claim can proceed. But clearly for now, you can see that the competition route isn't necessarily straightforward for claimants either.
Thanks, Julian. That's all very interesting and brings us to the end of our podcast for today. So I'll also say thank you to all of those listening, and we'll be back with further editions of this series.